All right, this is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. Yep, that's right, Michael Slate. Today, we're going to talk with you about two important topics. Fascism, which is still a thing, believe it or not, though having Trump out of office rather than being president for life has given us some breathing room. The other is the continuing and unimaginable loss of life and health due to the coronavirus. At the back end of the show, you're going to hear from Paul Street, author and activist and an editorial board member of Refuse Fascism, talking about science, fascism, and COVID-19. Before that, we'll hear a couple of segments from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and the architect of the new communism, talking about the fascists we're facing now. And opening the show up, I'm going to replay an interview with Jason Stanley, author of How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. Now, this is an invaluable book, and when you hear this interview, I'm sure you're going to be connecting what he's saying with what's happening right now every day. He provides a crucial understanding.
We're going to be talking with Jason Stanley, philosophy professor at Yale University and author of How Fascism Works. Now, Jason Stanley's parents survived the Holocaust in Germany, though millions of people did not, and he has spent the last 10 years studying fascism. He wants to scare us all, as someone said. I actually think he wants to ring the bell, and I like that Spike Lee film, Ring the Bell, and shouting to people, wake up, wake up, wake up. And he's here to talk with us about Donald Trump, the rise of fascism, what it means, and how people should be reacting. So, Jason, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Sure. Let's jump into this because I have 100 questions for you, okay?
Shoot.
Okay. I saw a clip of an event you did in Chicago, and you talked there. You started with a story about your father sitting you down and telling you about the reality of America and the America First movement. And, you know, I guess actually I hadn't been studied up on all this in the America First movement and the relationship between that and what your dad was telling you and what's going on in the country today. Let's talk about that.
So we have a president who's explicitly referencing the America First movement. If you look at history, if you look at, say, Bradley Hart's recent book, Hitler's American Friends, it's got like 5 chapters, I think, in it. One of the chapters is on the America First movement. The Nazis thought the America First movement and its representative, Charles Lindbergh, its spokesperson, was their main hope in the United States. I mean, we had a very healthy fascist movement. It obviously had clear links to a homegrown movement, the Ku Klux Klan, whose ideology is very much overlaps with German fascism. And we had this long history of white supremacy, white nationalism. I mean, it's not a history, it's our present. It's something that the United States always struggles with. And Charles Lindbergh writes in the Reader's Digest that it's time to build our walls, build our ramparts high to protect the white race against the Mongol horde, against the Persian horde, the Arab horde, you know. This is a long history of racial demagoguery against non-whites, and that's what we're tapping into in the current moment.
Yeah, you know, it's very heavy because it's like there's that, what you're talking about in terms of this long history, and then there is the reality of today, which really struck me because this, the aspect of people actually needing to know that what is the history of fascism and what it is in the U.S. and the fact that it isn't something foreign. It has a long and deep history. But the problem is that there's, you know, people don't realize even in this sense. I mean, I was one of the things that really surprised me in reading your book was you made a point that actually it's not like the U.S. is free from all this or is just following what happened in Germany and other places, but that actually
vice versa.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Germans were deeply influenced by the U.S. case. I mean, people don't understand what an outlier the United States was with its one-drop rule about that you were not white, you were black if you had one drop of blackness. As James Whitman discusses in Hitler's American Model, the Nuremberg lawyers carefully studied our anti-miscegenation laws and based the Nuremberg laws upon them, although they decided that one drop was untethered from reality and went instead with one-eighth. You're Jewish if you're one-eighth Jewish. So our racial laws were even too extreme for the National Socialists. Now, of course, time has changed, and we've fought. The story of America is the story of our struggle with white supremacy, and it's always a difficult struggle, and it's very slow movement and slipping back. Look at the PBS documentary Reconstruction. I mean, I was taught in school that Reconstruction failed. After the Civil War, they give 4 million black people to vote, and then suddenly there are black congressmen and senators and people in the state legislatures, and they panic and they remove the vote. And I was taught that was because black people couldn't self-govern. So, you know, so we have this long history, and what we're seeing with Trump is an aspect. Trump is very American, but he's also very fascist.
Yeah, we're going to get into that in a minute, because there's a couple of other things I wanted to ask you first. You know, this thing is just what you're starting to talk about. And the whole idea that, look, for me, it was really interesting in reading your book. It was and I really recommend that people get this book. It's well worth sitting down, reading it and rereading it. And it's Jason Stanley, How Fascism Works. You know, one of the things that really struck me there was that there really is this sort of all the various structural problems in the U.S. and how that actually brought people forward, not in a way to actually deal with all this stuff, in a way that could actually, you know, be, I don't know, whatever you would call digging in to try and do things in the right way and get, you know, get all this other stuff settled. It actually, you have people, the structural problems in the U.S. are bringing forward people that are turning to, helping them turning to fascism, which is really, you know, that is something I think people don't understand here.
Yeah, I mean, this is very clear in the literature on European fascism, Hannah Arendt's Origins of Totalitarianism. Chapter 10 is all about how fascism emerges when people become lonely, when you break down labor movements, when you break down movements that bring people together to better their lives. Then they, when they become lonely and isolated due to the deprivations of capitalism, then they turn for solace to identity movements that give them false, fake hopes of meaning. I mean, I don't think the thing about fascism is it's not good for white people. You know, it's not good for the people that it claims to be good for. As Hannah Arendt says, you know, fascism, you know, claims to advance the race, but in fact, it's just advancing the interests of those who are making these false promises. But those false what happens in these moments when people are isolated and afraid about their economic insecurity is that they turn to, they desire to see some kind of victory. And they'll sacrifice their own well-being if they think that their enemies, the liberals, the elites, are being humiliated and are being aggravated. So that's fascist politics. Fascist politics says, we're not going to give you anything. You're not going to get anything out of this, but what you will get is we're going to torment the people you hate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's jump into this, the structure of fascism and why it's so dangerous. I mean, that's something I think people really need to understand pretty deeply.
Right. So my book is divided into 10 chapters. Each chapter covers a different aspect of fascist politics. And for me, you know, the United States is not governed like it's not a fascist government right now. We have elements of that with our prison industrial system, with the carceral state. But we're not a fascist country by any means. But we're talking about political tactics. Fascism is best thought of as a set of political tactics that breaks down democratic ideals. Let's begin with what democratic ideals are. Democratic ideals are liberty and equality. And both of those are based on truth. If you've been lied to, nobody thinks the people of North Korea are free. They've been lied to, so that's why they're not free. They'll vote for Dear Leader every time because they've been lied to. Liberty requires truth. Equality requires truth because truth is speaking truth to power is how you equalize. So a democratic culture requires people to have respect for the truth, because that's how you equalize. So it requires, like, if a very powerful person lies and someone says, you're lying, that very powerful person will be humiliated, and if they lie too much, they won't be able to participate in public life. If you lose that, you lose your democratic culture, because then a powerless person can't call out a powerful person. So let me start by running down quickly the 10 chapters. The first tactic is the mythic past. All of fascist tactics are based on a big lie, because that's the way to get you to detach from the truth. So the mythic past, we were once great, but we've been humiliated on the national stage. So you could see President Trump did this in the 2016 election. Obama bowed and scraped. He didn't throw American power around. He humiliated us. We're going to return to our greatness. We were once great, you know, wink, wink about when that once was. Propaganda. There's a certain kind of propaganda that is very clear in fascism when things mean their opposite. Like, all fascist campaigns are anti-corruption campaigns. Even though the fascists themselves are more corrupt than anyone else, they tar their opponents with corruption because they say they this is useful for many reasons, but corruption means the wrong people are in charge. Chapter 3 is anti-intellectualism. You attack the press and the universities. So you should always worry when there's a systematic attack on the universities for being left-wing ideological indoctrination centers. So you attack the intellectual bastions, the press, for peddling leftism and liberalism under the guise of objectivity. You attack the universities for being like dens of Marxism and cultural Marxism. In Hungary, they just shut down the best university in Hungary, Central European University, for gender ideology and liberalism. So you always have to worry when there's a big attack on the universities and the press. Chapter 4, unreality. You float conspiracy theories. My first New York Times piece in 2011 was about birtherism, because knowing the history of fascism, that panicked me. When people, there's a way that conspiracy theories work. All the evidence against the conspiracy theories is actually treated as evidence for them. So the way the Nazis floated the protocols of the Elders of Zion, the Jews own the presses, they run the universities, they run the film and theater industry. And then when you said, when the presses refused to report on the protocols of the Elders of Zion, that was more evidence. Look, the press is not reporting that the Jews run the press. That just shows the Jews run the press. Similarly, President Trump in 2012 said, you can tell CNN is owned by Obama because they're controlled by Obama because they don't report on birtherism. So unreality, you destabilize people. So nobody knows what the truth is anymore, and they forget the truth. And they're like, I don't care about the truth. I know my guy is lying, but he's my guy. He's us. And his lies drive the other side crazy, and that's what I like. You know, so that's the fascist political sphere. It's just us versus them. Reality's irrelevant. Chapter 5 is hierarchy. You know, equality is a myth. Feminism is not seeking equality. It's seeking to take over. Black Lives Matter is not seeking equality. It's seeking to take over. Black people are seeking to take over. They don't want equality. So you represent the dominant group feels victimized. Trump supporters think the most victimized group in America are white Christians. So that goes into Chapter 6, victimhood. You have this incredible tapping of victimhood of the dominant group. The Nazis were like, the Germans are the most persecuted people in the world. We lost our empire. So you have this sense, you cultivate the sense that the persecuted people who are losing their traditions are the dominant group. And what are they victims of? Chapter 7 is law and order. They're victims of crime, of gangs, because those foreigners, and they're bringing in crime and drugs and gangs. So in Austria, Kickl, the far-right minister, he went around and told the police stations they're not allowed to talk to the mainstream press unless to report rapes of Austrian women by immigrants. So you create panicked fear about gang members and rapists, and that leads to the next chapter, which is sexual anxiety. You know, what crime do they do? Well, they do the crime of, they're rapists. We have to protect our women, and that's why we need a strong leader, because the strong leader is going to build a wall and protect our women from the foreigners. And you raise panic about homosexuality. You raise panic about turning boys into girls, because it's manlyhood that's prized in fascist politics. It's patriarchy. And then, you know, the first real fascist politics we had in recent years was Sarah Palin. So that hit the Chapter 9, Sodom and Gomorrah. The cities are the places of decadence and liberalism. That's where everyone mixes together. Chapter 2 of Mein Kampf is called Mein Time in Vienna. And he says, in Vienna, there were foreigners everywhere, foreign languages, and Jews, and more Jews. So the hated outgroup always lives in the cities. Think of what the expression inner city means in America. Cities are where black people live. It's where the immigrants live. And so you create the real Americans live in the countryside, rural versus urban divide. And Chapter 10 is called Arbeit macht frei, which was emblazoned on the gates of Auschwitz. Work shall make you free. Time and time again, the outgroup is always lazy. They're drains on the state. And you need to make them work for free in order to earn a work ethic. And that is at the heart. So that's why the idea in Nazi Germany was that Jews were lazy and never did any work. And they just got money because the government gave them, they worked in banking, and they just got money from interest and just were lazy. And you had to force them to work to give them a work ethic. And that's what is happening in our prison system right now. And then you target labor unions, because labor unions, you know, are about, you know, making workers' lives easier. But you need to break down labor unions because labor unions forge connections across racial divides.
Yeah, this is incredible, actually. And let me make a quick announcement here. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Jason Stanley, who is the author of the book, How Fascism Works. So let's get back into it. Now, Jason, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, too, and you've been hitting at some of it, but there's this point about why exactly this is so dangerous, you know, because you're thinking like, okay, you go through this, you have Lindbergh, all these people early on talking about fascism. Fascism raises its head, you know, throughout the decades that we've been around, that we've been alive over, you know, since the 1920s all the way up or 19th. And even 1930, you have, who was it? Is it Bannon that talked about it's going to be a good year because it's a lot like 1930, something like that.
Said, he said, we're going to, in a Hollywood Reporter interview, he said it's going to be exciting like the 1930s. Yeah. Now, he's always winking. So, yeah, that's the decade he goes back to, and that's the decade where the United – now, it's tricky because Bannon has plausible deniability. He'll say, I meant the New Deal, but I'm skeptical that he meant the New Deal.
Yeah, I think you're right to be skeptical. It's sort of – yeah. But the thing is like when you – and that gets into this character of the fascist tactics. And, you know, it is really – there's something that you keep bringing up in your book that really struck me, that fascism seeks to replace truth by power, and that there's a very particular method to doing that. Let's talk about that.
So – the method is you get people, you try to replace, so truth balances out loyalty. If we recognize the truth, if we recognize facts, so I don't mean like a deep truth. So people think that the Russian language makes a distinction between deep truth and truth. So that's why that covers propaganda. You lie, but you lie to reveal a deeper truth. I'm talking about just facts. So the enemy of fascism is just facts, just ordinary facts. Because ordinary facts, if everyone has loyalty to ordinary facts, then, you know, it's hard to get away with stuff. They're just ordinary facts. And you have to have a democratic culture requires that people are humiliated when they lie about ordinary facts. But what you try to do is you try to say, look, the whole system is corrupt. Everybody's lying. Think of Fox News's slogan, old slogan, fair and balanced. Everyone knew Fox News was not fair and balanced. The point of that slogan was to suggest that no one is fair and balanced, that Fox News is just as fair and balanced as everyone else, meaning not fair and balanced at all, because everyone is corrupt, everyone is lying. So you break down trust. You break down trust between citizens. So everyone is just like, okay, I don't know what's true anymore. I don't even care what's true. I just care about my guy winning, and I care about my guy winning and humiliating those liberal cosmopolitan elites and making them feel miserable. What we call owning the libs. And if you go back throughout fascist politics to the 1930s, to the German and Italian fascist movements, that's what it was about. It's about humiliating the elite. It was about bringing them down and, you know, and doing it in the service of your guy gaining power. And so it's like following sports teams. Sports is healthy because it takes away our fascist inclinations and focuses them on something it's fine to root for. It's totally fine for me to be like a total supporter of the New York Knicks because, you know, painful as it is in recent years, you know, that's my team. But that's not the attitude you want to bring to politics. The Democratic Party is not your team. The Republican Party is not your team. The truth is your team. So what you're trying to do is you're trying to raise conspiracy theories to try to humiliate the opponent, to try to just tar them with worst things ever, and just make politics into spectacle and show instead of – that's the other thing that we find. So you find Arendt talking about that all the time. She said, in fascism, people are glued to the screen. They're no longer – the news is no longer the news. The news is entertainment. The news is like, what's happening now in the ever-crazy turmoil of the administration? Who's in? Who's out? And then no one is following anymore. They get addicted to this, like, spectacle of excitement. And then – you know, instead of like the boring policy of healthy democratic give and take.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things as you're talking, I kept going back to this where you get, you know, you talk about in the book, you talk about, you know, Hitler and value comes from victory and struggle, as you've been pointing to, but that also that if you want to get rid of political equality, you actually, this is what you do. You get rid of people's respect for the truth, which is really an interesting thing to posit.
Absolutely. The truth is much more important than people realize, and people are giving it up just to, like, own the libs far too easily. You know, Trump supporters understand he's lying constantly, but think it's cool. They think it's cool because it you know, triggers the libs. But, you know, if we all step back, Trump supporters and non-Trump supporters, and say, how about we go back to a culture where we just focus on the truth and it's not about, like, humiliating people anymore, because that's not a politics, actually. Politics should be like, here's this, you know, let's talk about a $1 wage raise. Let's talk about the weekend and how we're losing the weekend. Like, I kind of like the weekend. It took the unions a long time to get us the weekend. Let's hold on to the weekend, you know. And to get people back to that level and to get people back to respecting the truth, it's a humble thing. It's a little thing, but it's the center of democratic culture.
Mm-hmm. Now, you think about this. It's, you know, it's a lot of the things that you're talking about, you also go into a section in your book where you talk about that thinking of the normalcy of fascist ideology, you know, that there's a normalization of that going on, and it's very dangerous. And if you think about that, you bring up the term American exceptionalism, and it's constantly brought up generation after generation, and this is very dangerous.
Very dangerous. Very dangerous. So part two of Hannah Arendt's Origins of Totalitarianism is called imperialism. M.A. Césaire in Discourse on Colonialism speaks regularly about, he says, Hitler's the worst person on earth, not because of what he did, but because of who he did it to, Europeans. He was doing to Europeans what the Belgians had done in the Congo when they killed 10 million people, like imperialism. And Hitler, of course, was infuriated, as Du Bois and The World in Africa brings out, was infuriated by the loss of the German colonies in Africa. Imperialism, the idea that the world is yours, is a very dangerous thing. So 9/11 really triggered a lot of what's happening now, because 9/11 was, we lied ourselves, we got comfortable lying ourselves into a colonial war. We sold ourselves on we're spreading democracy. And here's the thing. I mean, Trump was very sophisticated about this, and I respect him immensely for the intelligence this took. He said, we're not good. Look at the Iraq War. So that always happens. When you become hypocritical with your colonialism, when it becomes just too obvious that you're not spreading democracy, you're in fact crushing people under your boot, then someone is going to come and say, hey, crush, that's what we do. We crush people under our boot. And that's fascism.
You know,
so imperialism leads directly to fascism. The Iraq War led directly to our moment.
Boy, that's pretty heavy. Wow. Tell me this. This thing you talk about in the book about fascist inversion and ideas used to undermine themselves. And then I was thinking about that whole process actually can be used to undermine the entire society. You know, these anti-corruption campaigns, the unreality you referred to earlier, and then something that you also talk about, which we'll get into in a minute, but the victimhood that's actually been really out there now. So let's just first talk about this fascist inversion. What do you mean by that, and why is it so dangerous?
So remember there was a Saturday Night Live early on in the Trump administration where they had the Breaking Bad actor, played the Walter White character, come and as the new head of the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency, as a joke, you know, because Trump kept on appointing people who were the opposite of their agencies. Mick Mulvaney was running the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Everyone running, you know, he put Rick Perry as the Secretary of Energy. I believe it's Secretary of Energy. He put people who wanted to dismantle the very agencies they were running as head of the agencies. So he was inverting everything. So fascists run. So I talk about the example. I mean, this inversion point is familiar from literature. George Orwell's 1984, War is Peace. So think about, do you know what the name of Guantanamo Bay is? Camp Justice. So this inversion where you represent things as their opposite. So how was Trump able to run an anti-corruption campaign? I mean, the New York Times investigation revealed the depths of his corruption, of his business corruption. So how is he able to run this anti-corruption campaign? Well, he's able to run it by painting the system as corrupt and rigged. And to be honest, the system had a lot of was pretty corrupt and rigged. But that's very dangerous when that happens. When you can paint the system as corrupt and rigged, then you can run. Then the corrupt candidate becomes like the authentic candidate. He's the one who's openly corrupt, and everyone's like, well, he's not hiding anything. He's openly corrupt. And so they can be the anti-corruption candidate. But it's a joke. Then they run and then they go into office. He's representing the little man. He has a $1.5 trillion tax cut for the oligarchs that fund him and himself. So everything means it's opposite, but it's fine because he's triggering the libs.
Mm-hmm. Boy. All right, I have a couple more questions here for you. And when we're talking about this, it's part of this thing of, I don't know, it's sort of like the, you know, you've just been talking about a little, the politics of fascism, of pollution and corruption. But there's another thing that actually sticks out really, really sharply in relation to Trump and fascism and the situation of people in this country and in the world right now. And in particular, I was really intrigued by this thing of Trump and young black men who by their existence, their very existence, are violations of law and order, labeled rapists or whatever. Young black men are targets under this fascist stuff.
Right. So things don't mean, under fascism, things mean their opposite. They don't mean, so law and order doesn't mean law and order. So as I talk about in the book, when Jeff Sessions in November 2016 said, you can tell from Trump's response to the Central Park 5 case that he's going to be a law and order president. What was meant by that? The Central Park Five were five completely innocent young black men who were arrested for a crime they did not commit, and every possible, there was no physical evidence connecting them to the crime. There was the sperm found there was later shown to be the sperm of a convicted rapist who was on a spree at the time. So they were completely innocent, and they got a settlement from New York City, and Trump said, no, they're guilty. New York City shouldn't have paid the settlement. So what does it mean that Sessions said, oh, he's a law and order president? Law and order is punishing, is making sure that people who are guilty for the crimes face, that society is protected from them, and we do something about that situation. It doesn't mean punishing the innocent for crimes they didn't do. Well, law and order under fascist politics means the out-group, the young Hispanic men, young black men, they are, by their very nature, violations of law and order. They're criminals. The Nazis, too, painted the German Jews as criminals. When the Nazis ran, they said, we're going to imprison all the criminal Jews. And many Jewish people said, okay, they're not going after me. But it turned out they meant people with traffic tickets, speeding tickets, exactly what's happening with immigrants right now.
Mm. All right, one last question, and this is one that actually I think is... I think it's imperative for people to pay attention to. It's the chapter Arbeit macht frei. And I wanted to ask you about that because it's actually something that I think in some ways brings together everything that you've just been talking about. So let's get into that.
So Arbeit macht frei is about the fact, so fascism is based on social Darwinism. So social Darwinism is the view that value goes with whoever, with the winner. There's winners, and you always got to, people are channeling social Darwinism when you have politicians talking about winners and losers. If you hear a politician talking about, well, there's winners and there's losers and I don't like the loser, that's social Darwinism. That's the idea that value only goes with the winners. If you want a good, handy mnemonic to realize how bad that is and how dangerous it is, think of the Nazi T4 program where they gassed the disabled. Why did they gas the disabled? Because the Nazis held they had no value because they couldn't do hard work. So they couldn't fight in a competitive market. So social Darwinism is at the core of Nazism. Now, fascism is not social Darwinism of the individual. So economic libertarianism is social Darwinism of the individual. It, too, I believe, is a dangerous doctrine, but it's an acceptable doctrine to have in a free society. You know, libertarians are anti-fascists because they restrict their social Darwinism to the individual. Fascists say certain groups have more value than other groups. Americans have more value than non-Americans. Whites have more values than blacks. Jews have more values than Palestinians. That's the sort of social Darwinism of the group that you find in fascist thinking. And the idea is, and then there's this fiction that there's this hierarchy of value that's been created by hard work. The in-group, the German ideology was that Germans were hard workers, and they worked hard, and Jews were lazy. And they lived off interest and banking, and so you had to force them to do free labor. So you can distinguish the valuable group, because they're hard workers, from the lazy people. And the lazy people have lesser value, and that's the structure of the hierarchy. The lazy people are rapists and criminals, and they're lazy. the valuable people are hard workers and law-abiding. And that's how you construct the value. And labor unions, they try to make it easier. And we don't want to make the workers' lives easier because hard work gives you value. Now, in fact, hard work is not at the center of liberalism. Like, it's not the case that you have value because you're better at working longer hours. You have value in liberalism because you are a human being worthy of dignity.
Mm-hmm. All right, Jason. Anything you'd like to add before we leave?
No, I think that's How Fascism Works covers it, and you've done a great job of asking about its themes.
Thank you, man. I really think people should get this book, check it out, read it, pass it around. Very important, especially in this time that we're living in. So, Jason Stanley, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Michael.
All right, take care. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Jason Stanley, philosophy professor at Yale University and author of How Fascism Works. Jason Stanley's parents survived the Holocaust in Germany, though millions did not. He has spent the last 10 years studying fascism, and he's produced an incredibly important book that people should definitely check out. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. That was Christo Fascist by Art Bergman and Wayne Kramer. Now, for a further understanding of the fascism of the Trump-Pence regime, its roots in the history of this country, and why it's come to the fore at this time, there's an unparalleled resource in this talk by Bob Avakian, The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept the fascist America. A better world is possible. This week, RevCom.us posted a New Year's statement by Bob Avakian. A new year, the urgent need for a radically new world, for the emancipation of all humanity. We'll be talking more about this in the coming weeks, but one short quotation brings home one of the things that we're facing. The unavoidable truth is that this country, the much-proclaimed shining city on the hill, is full of fascists, in the government at all levels and in large parts of the society as a whole. So, we're going to hear a few excerpts from this talk. The Trump-Pence regime must go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept the fascist America. A better world is possible. Beginning with the direct line from the Confederacy to the fascists of today.
And the fact is that in this country, with its whole history of genocide, slavery, and racism, any form of fascism, including one basing itself on Christian supremacy, any urge to restore past greatness, cannot help but be bound together with white supremacy. The Republican Party has been moving in a fascist direction since the late 1960s, with further leaps since then to becoming more and more openly fascist. And in running for president in 1968, Richard Nixon adopted what has been called the Southern Strategy, which the Republican Party has followed ever since. This is a direct appeal to white supremacy, to the racism of white people, particularly, though not only, in the southern states, who are enraged that black people are not staying in their place. The Republican Party is not the party of Lincoln, as it sometimes demagogically claims to be. It has become much more the party of the Confederacy. With Ronald Reagan, the Republican Party took another leap on the road of fascism. Reagan very deliberately began his campaign for president in 1980 in Philadelphia, Mississippi, where in 1964, three civil rights workers were kidnapped and brutally murdered by white supremacists. There, In Philadelphia, Mississippi, Reagan proclaimed his support for states' rights, which, particularly in the South, have long been code words for white supremacist lynch mobism. And after George W. Bush took things still further in a fascist direction, including the open use of torture and the active promotion of Christian fundamentalism, the Trump-Pence regime has made the leap into all-out fascism. There is a direct line from the Confederacy to the fascists of today, and a direct connection between their white supremacy, their open disgust and hatred for LGBT people as well as women, their willful rejection of science and the scientific method, their raw America First jingoism and trumpeting of the superiority of Western civilization, and their bellicose wielding of military power, including their expressed willingness and blatant threats to use nuclear weapons to destroy countries. The truth, another terrible truth that must be faced, is that in the context of profound and acute contradictions that are asserting or reasserting themselves in ways that are tearing at the very fabric and deepening cracks in the foundation of this country, at the same time as the American empire is facing serious challenges internationally, fascism is one possible resolution of this, on the terms of this system and its ruling class, even as this is a horror for humanity.
Okay, that was Bob Avakian, the most important political thinker in the world today, with his piece, The Direct Line from the Confederacy to the Fascists of Today. Next, we're going to hear an excerpt on The Fundamentalist Christians Now in Power Are Christian Fascists. Of course, they're not in power right now, but they're still there. Several observers have noted that many of the fascist mob that assaulted the U.S. Capitol on January 6th were Christian nationalists. Samuel L. Perry, co-author of Taking America Back for God, said the Capitol insurrection was as Christian nationalist as it gets. So let's hear Bob Avakian break down the Christian fascist core of the fascist movement in America.
Perhaps it seems harsh or even extreme to refer to these fundamentalist Christians as fascists. Well, in Catherine Stewart's book, The Good News Club, The Christian Right's Stealth Assault on Americans' Children, she cites these comments by Rich Lang, himself a former Christian fundamentalist who broke with that and became a liberal Christian pastor. When I was born again, Lang recalls, faith was something inside of you, something you were supposed to reflect through your life. But in the 1980s, something happened. Fundamentalist Christianity jumped back into the public square with the intention to reshape the country as a Christian nation as defined by them. It's no different than the Nazis wanting to start with the Hitler Youth. That is where you'd want to start if you were trying to build a fascist movement. That's the word, fascism. Nobody likes to use it in this country. But I believe that in this country, underneath the appearances, that is exactly the great temptation of our time. And you have to call it what it is, Christian fascism. Stewart further summarizes Lang's views this way. Modern fundamentalism, like fascism in earlier times, he says, involves a strong feeling of persecution, typically at the hands of godless liberals or a religious other. The belief that one belongs to a pure race or national group that is responsible for past greatness, suffers unjust oppression in the present, and is the rightful ruler of the world. The impulse to submit unquestioningly to absolute authority, and the relentless drive for power and control. It is, he says, a kind of supremacist movement with religion rather than race at its core. And there is this chilling statement by Lang. People have no idea it's going on. What does it mean that the conservative church that's growing in America is an end times church? What does it mean that we are raising a generation of children to believe that they are the last generation? What is going to happen if we keep on telling them, don't care about the environment and bring on the war because we're going to be lifted out of here? And you can forget about loving your neighbors because they're just going to get blown away. So that is the insight of someone very familiar with these Christian fascists. And the fact is that in this country, with its whole history of genocide, slavery, and racism, any form of fascism, including one basing itself on Christian supremacy, any urge to restore past greatness cannot help but be bound together with white supremacy.
That was Bob Avakian from The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. A better world is possible. This is KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. That was Function Underground. Now, we're going to hear something from Paul Street on the COVID-19 epidemic in the U.S. and the world and how this has been perpetuated and made much worse, not just by Trump and his science-denying fascists, but by the capitalist system itself. New forms of the virus have emerged in South Africa and Brazil and are spreading around the world. In parts of Brazil, medical resources have been overwhelmed. Doctors have been forced by necessity into the cruel practice of triage, allowing the sickest patients to die so they can save the others with limited resources. The U.S. is approaching 500,000 dead, and the use of long-awaited vaccines has been marked by the deadly inequalities of U.S. society. This is another area we hope to be covering a lot more in the coming weeks. So let's hear Paul Street, award-winning journalist, historian, author, and speaker, and member of the editorial board of Refuse Fascism. He was speaking in December on a live stream sponsored by Refuse Fascism and the Revolution Nothing Less show called COVID, a case study with life and death stakes, science, epistemology, conspiracy, and fascism.
And our first speaker is Paul Street, author of Hollow Resistance, Obama, Trump, and the Politics of Appeasement, and my colleague on the editorial board of refusefascism.org. Welcome, Paul. How are you doing tonight?
I'm all right. Thanks, Coco.
So we're eager to hear from you. So we're going to, I'm going to let you take the mic.
All right. Very good. Here we go. The COVID pandemic, the COVID-19 pandemic, as it has played out in its favored country, the United States of America, is a tragedy. It will soon have claimed the lives of more than one in every 1,000 Americans. Think about that. But it is also a fascism crime rooted in this nation's multiple, overlapping, and mutually reinforcing structures, institutions, policies, and ideologies of inequality and oppression. It is an epitome of the failed state spiritual death and fascism that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said would befall this nation if it did not move off of what he called the triple evils that are interrelated: capitalism, racism, and imperialism, militarism. It is a crime of global capitalism, the rapacious and parasitic system that digs up zoonotic viruses from its ever-expanding geographical frontier and then sends those viruses around the world in the flash of an eye. Capitalism in its extreme US form compels millions of vulnerable Americans to work without adequate virus protection or else go without money for purchasing life's necessities. It is a system that denies millions of Americans adequate health care and that disincentivizes and prevented the provision and production of medical supplies, beds, personnel, and equipment to meet a pandemic that medical science and public health experts had been warning about for many years. It is an anarchic, competitive system that absurdly complicates medical production and distribution, and that renders hundreds of millions of Americans vulnerable to terrible outcomes by poisoning their bodies, air, water, and soil with toxic chemicals. COVID is a crime of American racism, which forces tens of millions of non-white Americans to live in overcrowded residences and communities without access to healthy food, medical care, and green space. Virulent American racism, which is as old as the Republic itself, concentrates millions of impoverished Black, Brown, and Red people into jails, prisons, detention centers, reservations, concentration camps that have proven to be COVID-19 breeding grounds and petri dishes. Racism concentrates non-white people in the most vulnerable jobs, in packing house kill floors in Iowa, Nebraska, in nursing home, and working as nursing home orderlies all across the nation. COVID-19 is a crime of American imperialism, which, among other things, steals resources from public health and medicine, taking money, skills, and personnel that should be invested in healing, and pouring all of that instead into a giant military death state that accounts for more than 40% of global war spending. If I had more time, and I don't, I'd talk about how COVID-19 is a crime of American sexism, of American individualism, of American federalism, of American nativism, of American right-wing evangelical Christianity, and of American anti-intellectualism, and even, ask me about this later, of American electoralism. But I want to get to the more central and more immediate culpability of Trumpism, fascism. I believe my fellow presenter tonight, Dr. Phil Rice, is going to get into some of the specifics on what was scientifically and medically necessary and how the Trump regime thwarted all of that in absolutely disastrous and despicable ways that have had made the world's so-called greatest country into a sanctuary nation for COVID-19, giving us more than a fifth of the world's COVID cases in a nation that accounts for less than a 20th of global population. But my thing is the why of that, criminal mass murderous incompetence. And here I think it's a good place to set down a marker that sets refuse fascism and its allies a bit apart from the mainstream explanation. The mainstream standard common sense explanation of why Trump screwed up so badly on COVID-19, which, by the way, is written all over the front page New York Times piece today about how the Trump administration crushed the Center for Disease Control's COVID response capacity. But as far as I can tell, the mainstream common sense explanation is that Trump didn't want to do or say anything that might undercut the economic growth that he expected to ride to re-election this year. That's the main story that I expect to go into the liberal history textbooks that roll off the academic presses next year. And the problem with that conventional explanation is not that it's wrong. That's a huge part of it, absolutely a significant and central part of it. My sense, however, is that it was much worse than just that. And that alone was pretty awful, pretty criminal, pretty bad. My sense is that when the full story comes out, we or those of us willing to look are going to see that Trump's criminal COVID-19 conduct, we started calling it COVID-45, to be honest with you, this summer, that his criminal COVID conduct wasn't only about Trump's malignant narcissism and selfishness and electoral calculations, but was also about his and Stephen Miller and Tucker Carlson and the rest of the whole Republic fascist empires and fascistic characteristics of the Trump Pence regime. One, an eliminationist neo-McCarthyite desire to paint out the other major capitalist party as a totalitarian socialist enemy of personal freedom and glory, supposedly glorious, wonderful capitalism. Two, white supremacist satisfaction with a virus that was disproportionately killing off people of color. Three, a related social Darwinian and even eugenicist comfort with COVID's disastrous impact on the aged and on the infirm, on the old and the sick, the people that the Nazis, the surplus people that the Nazis considered, quote unquote, useless eaters. Four, an initial eliminationist calculation that the virus would mainly target cities controlled by the other major capitalist party, the disproportionately non-white blue metropolitan urban zones of the country. Five, a sexist, hyper-masculinist sense that the masks and social distancing are signs of effeminate weakness and fear, not manly. Six, a passionate hostility to science that is particularly pronounced in American-style fascism because of the special strength of evangelical Christianity in the American right. Seven, a personality cult built up around dear leader, stable genius Donald Trump, and a related sense that his instincts and the power of his will trumped any competitive claim to authority on the part of mere scientists and public health professionals. Eight, the core fascist drive to purge all officials who are perceived as disloyal. And many folks in the bureaucracy just had too many loyalties to their own professions and their own scientific background to not get purged by Trump, not get crushed by Trump. Ninth, the continuing but fascism intensifying war of the right, not on the state per se, that's an illusion. The claims of government that the right wing is anti-government are false. They're war not on the state per se, but on the left hand of the state, that is on any parts of government that serve the broad majority of the population and social democracy and public health and the common good. I want to conclude with an irony. And this is actually something I wrote myself at some point in Counterpunch in the last few weeks. I remember writing a paragraph to this effect of, this fascist SOB, this fascistic regime that separated children at the border, that put kids in cages, that set up concentration camps, that tore up every environmental regulation, everything, all the things we didn't get impeached for, and just go through the list. We could stay here for 3 hours. All the worst sins and transgressions of the Trump regime probably would, this fascist regime probably would have got a second term, but for COVID, right? And I think that's true. The exit polling data I've seen on that really tells me that COVID really undid. If it wouldn't have given Trump an out-and-out electoral victory, the election would have been close enough for them to actually credibly have pulled off a coup and pulled off a steal. But there's a problem with this narrative, too. First one is COVID wasn't some outside externality or historical contingency that came out of nowhere and undid Trump. He blew COVID up. He needs to own this thing. That's why we called him COVID 45. He turned this, he turned the United States into COVID's top most favored nation in the world. And second of all, he did that because of the fascism. Not exclusively because of the fascism. A lot of things went into play in this. Capitalism is huge. But he did this largely because of the capitalism. I do want to finish off with informal, just shout out to Refuse Fascism. This aftermath, even as much as the regime itself, is living proof the Refuse Fascism and its allies added correct. This is exactly how you would expect a fascist regime to respond to the loss of an election. This line that I'm hearing in intellectual circles that well, the aftermath, the loss proves that that we were crying wolf and we were just raising alarms that we shouldn't have been and that we were hysterical. Look at the behavior since this regime It's and look at the conduct that's clearly not going away anytime soon. And look at our slogan, out now. It is it was the right slogan, and it is still the right slogan. We are losing a 9/11 and a Pearl Harbor quantity of people every goddamn day in this country. This regime should be forced out immediately. It's doing everything it can to undermine a safe public health transition to the next government. It's criminal, it's profoundly transgressive, and it is fascist. I still say Trump, Pence, out now. Thank you.
All right, that was Paul Street, award-winning journalist, historian, author, and speaker, and member of the editorial board of Refuse Fascism. He was speaking in December on COVID, a case study with life and death stakes, science, epistemology, conspiracy, and fascism. And before we go out today, I'll repeat some of the pieces that I referenced. A New Year, the Urgent Need for a Radically New World for the Emancipation of All Humanity. That's a new statement from Bob Avakian, and it's posted now at revcom.us. That's R-E-V as in Victor, C-O-M.us. All right, and hopefully we'll be talking about that in the near future. There's a lot more at revcom.us as well, including the video, The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go, In the Name of Humanity, We Refuse to Accept a Fascist America, a Better World is Possible. And that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to share your thoughts and ideas about the show, or if you want to volunteer to be part of the show, write to me at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. I waited all my life to play, but I still can't find a way. But if I work it one more day, I might just break the chain. I might just break the chain. I might just break the chain. That, especially where we from, where we grew up, like a green thumb, like a criminal, the only thing you could become. Look at what I became, something like a phenom, nothing but a G thing. Things I've seen when I'm looking out of these frames, pictures I painted on the walls where we hang. From the trees we hung, strange fruit man, look at how we swung. How the hell you gonna tell a son who ain't have a father how to try to grow up and be one? Feel it in my bones and I'm sitting on the throne like a killer with the chrome. When I'm spitting out the poem, shed a whole lot of light on a little bit of home. Bam.